Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and right now I'm on Zoom with a pair of filmmakers who made a feature film that was at Filmvasion Los Angeles in 2020. We've got Sarah Goer and Kip Callendine. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Jeff.
All right. So normally in my introduction, I mention the TV series and stuff that's associated with this podcast, but I'm going to put that on the back burner because you made a feature film that is not part of the Discover Indie Film TV series. So why don't you tell me if this is answerable? If it's not answerable, maybe we should start over. But is there somewhere that people can watch Three Roads right now? The name of the film is Three Roads.
Actually, yes. At the moment, it is up on Vimeo for free.
Vimeo for free. Excellent.
Please go enjoy.
We're not going to worry about spoilers during this chat about Sarah and Kip and their careers and what led them to make this film. But so there might be some spoilers. So I highly recommend everyone go watch. I guess, is there somewhere they should search on Vimeo? Like, is there, does Three Roads get it?
Let me check right now. I feel like if you just Google Three Roads in our name, you might turn it up. Three Roads.
Yeah, definitely if you searched on Vimeo, Three Roads, and you use the last name Callendine or Goer, G-O-E-R, I'm sure people would get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very funny. A woman who made a beautiful animated film called The Cat said, it's on YouTube if you want to see it. And I said to the, this is live at a Q&A last month at Sherman's Film Fest. And I said, by the way, if you type in the words, the cat, into YouTube, yeah, you will not get her film.
You will never find it.
There's only like,
you'll be entertained, but not by that film.
2 billion cat videos. And then an amazing animated film that takes place in Tehran. It's like totally not going to come up for the cat, but Three Roads, I think is a pretty unique title too.
Probably. Yeah, and our names are unique too. So I think with that combination of the Google, you can find it.
All right, kind podcast listener, watch Three Roads. And now we're going to jump in. Either one of you go first. I always ask on the podcast, where did your creative side flourish? Did you get interested in writing or acting or just general film, playing with cameras as young people, doing school plays? Tell me what got you started. Sarah, why don't you go first?
Sure. My mother and sister were heavily involved in community theater, and I, as a little girl, would watch them, and I really wanted to be on stage with them, and so I started doing community theater as well, and then as I evolved, realized that the craft of acting is deeply meaningful to me, and so went and got serious training and started making films. It was one of those things where I started making films because I was impatient and didn't want to wait around for people to cast me. And when I very first began, I was like, this is hard. I don't want to do this, but acting's too important to me. I guess I will. And it turned out to be this blessing because actually I am a creative producer. Actually, I am a writer. And actually, I have way too much to say and way too many opinions to just wait around for people to cast me in things I may or may not be excited to be a part of.
Excellent. And was it like high school that woke up or college era?
Or even post? So I came from a very like rational, intellectual family, and they never pooped on my creative dreams. They weren't discouraging. So I'm very lucky in that regard, but they didn't know like how much of an artist I really am. I had to discover that more as an adult. And so when I went to college, I went with I'm like, okay, I think I really want to be an actor. That's insane. So I'll go to college. I'll do something more, you know, practical where I could see a career path. And then if I still want to be an actor after college, I'll go to a conservatory. And that's more or less what I ended up doing.
And you were growing up in Northern California?
Yeah. Yeah. Bay Area.
Right.
Did you ever tell me what you majored in college?
Well, you know that plan where I was going to major in something more practical? I couldn't. I was too impatient, and I ended up designing my own performance studies major.
Oh, wow.
Because I just, you know, it's like my heart and my emotions were guiding me one way while my head was busy thinking a different thing. And it just took a while for the two to catch up, but my heart knew all along. I was going to major in foreign languages. In high school, I took Japanese, Spanish, and French, and I was going to major in foreign languages and be an interpreter.
Wow.
But I changed my mind.
You traded one set.
Language skills? Mm-hmm. Still got language skills?
Un poco, pero no hablo muy, muy bien.
I was just thinking, you know, there's always a market for foreign films that are actually made here.
Yeah.
Although I think it's mostly Chinese. Oh, well, that's actually cool. And so you did the conservatory thing after getting the bachelor's?
More or less, yeah. It wasn't, so I ended up somewhere along my high school journey discovered that the Meisner technique is like really my jam as an actor. And it turned out after college that one of the very few people still teaching on this earth who Sanford Meisner handpicked, like, and was like, I want you to learn how to teach my technique, taught and still teaches in San Francisco. And so I went and studied with him. And he teaches he runs the program, like, very similar to how Meisner ran his 2-year conservatory.
Oh, fantastic.
That's Jim Jarrett, if anybody needs an acting teacher in San Francisco. Very talented teacher and incredible performer.
I bet the Bay Area was a really good place to be a young creative person because it's a legit artistic center, but it doesn't have the weight of, like, the L.A. scene where, you know, half of the excited young people in the country have moved here and end up waiting tables and trying to elbow each other out of the way. Like, I would imagine coming up in the Bay Area might be healthier. Just like I've heard, like, stand-up comedians say that, you know, working the club scene in the Bay Area was a more positive start than if they'd moved to L.A. too early.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Although I would say, I think... in an ideal world, like if somebody really wants to be a famous actor, a famous director, a famous writer, what would be ideal is no matter where you are living, believing in yourself as an artist from a very early age and then moving out to LA when you're young, like before college, but having a great, like, healthy emotional base because LA loves young people. And I think it's harder to break in once you are no longer that very young age. But then conversely, that can be tricky because if you don't have that emotional grounded support and like mental health, you're going to be a mess. So
I have a guilty confession, which is once on a cruise ship, I picked up Anna Kendrick's biography and autobiography. And that was her story. And actually... kind of amazing. I actually highly recommend the book.
Oh, yeah. I listened to the audiobook. I really liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was sort of like you made me think of that. Like she came here young and struggled, but had the emotional health to keep her wits about her as she went about it all. And yeah, took advantage of being young in the culture where youth is worshipped for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I think we should definitely jump on to Kip's story. So what got you into filmmaking?
Well, I was more the type where as early as I can remember, I've been kind of obsessed with film, you know, to the extent where I was too young to understand that it was, you know, it was fantasy and it was also a, you know, kind of a creative endeavor in the sense of like, I thought the actors... For the longest time, I thought the actors made the movie, you know, like I thought they came up with the story as they went and they just pretended they were these people. And I even specifically remember realizing like, oh, well, the actors aren't dying when they die in the movie. Cause I would, you know, who would actually do that? And that being like a eureka moment. So, it was kind of one of those things for me. I was always drawn to film. I used to pretend to be my favorite movie characters. Like when I was like 2 years old, my parents for a minute thought I had a neurological disorder because I would impersonate the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz, you know? And so I'd do kind of these herky jerky movements and they were like, what's he doing? What's wrong with him? And it turned out I was just, you know, I was okay. But, relatively speaking and, yeah, it's been that. It's just been kind of a lifetime love affair with storytelling in general and especially with film. Just, you know, as I've grown older, it's just been this thing that's bloomed for me where I can always find new things to appreciate in it, you know. And like early on, I think it was the acting and just the simple story element of it and the imagination of Star Wars and there being this other universe where there's the Force and starships and Star Trek was another, you know, early love affair for me. You know, and then with age, it's like I've come to appreciate stuff that's more maybe sophisticated, like the photography and the music and the production design and the nuts and bolts of the screenwriting. Yeah.
And did you, were you first drawn to the acting side of it, or did you start playing with video cameras, or?
Well, like I said, like, I think it was the acting initially, but it was also because I thought they came up with everything, the people on screen, you know? And so I think, I guess you can say it was character that I really lit onto, and then how the characters reacted to the circumstances that they were going through.
Right. So you got involved in acting as a, in school?
Yeah. Well, no, not really in school so much. I did take some acting classes when I was a younger kid. And I actually really liked it. And I'm, you know, I think it was family stuff that led to me to nothing really germinating with that. But, I remember really distinctly, like when the DVD came out, and my parents had like two DVDs and I watched them ad nauseum. They were Fly Away Home and Twister. And I remember Twister had a featurette that was like a making of, and it was the first thing I'd seen like that. And I saw a dude with a bullhorn yelling at everyone. And I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. I was like, that's the guy telling the actors what to do. It was another eureka moment. And I'm still drawn to the acting of it, but it's like, I think I'm a little too much of, maybe I'm too much of a control freak, or I want to kind of control the pots in the kitchen that, I don't know if I ever could just act. Yeah, even.
And you know, Sarah's nodding because she has to keep writing and doing neither of you want to just act.
The only, if you want to just act, you have to be well suited. Like, it has to be a part of your personality that you really want to serve other people's vision. And that's all you want. Like, you love the craft, you love taking charge of your character, but ultimately you want to serve the other people's vision, especially in film, you know, as opposed to theater, for example, or audiobooks, which is also even more, performer based than theater. And I just can't, I have too much to say. So similar to you, Kip, you know, it's a terrible career if you have a strong opinion about the story until you're famous, in which case, you know, if you're famous, then, you know, but that's a long shot, for anyone, no matter how talented and skilled you are.
It is, no matter what, it's a collaborative medium. It's also, I mean, film is sort of a director's medium. And, you know, I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, how it's sort of divided and sort of, it's always sort of been a maxim that stage is more actor centric because there's only so much control the playwright and director have once they're on stage. And then film is more director centric because someone has to be the last decider. and then TV, actually, I've always thought it was more writer centric because in the end you need the people pumping out the scripts every month end up being the showrunners and control, you know, then the directors just rotate. The director in TV is almost,
I think the question is probably, in my opinion, would be that in truth it's not really whose medium is it, it's who's the scapegoat, you know, for when things go right or things go wrong, you know. And because I think like that, like a TV show, the actors definitely have a huge amount of involvement in how successful it is. And you can look at it and say, well, the writer came up with all of it. The writer developed the characters and stuff, but it's, everyone has their ingredient that they add to the stew. And sure, it can make the whole stew go bad, or it can really be the thing that really elevates it. But yeah, I don't know if it's possible to really parse out with
like, probably not
as collaborative as, yeah.
I think I'm just generally saying that, like, in TV, the writers get to boss around the director and fire them if they need to. Whereas in film, never.
Right.
So really the people with the power are the top creative producers who put the whole team together. That's what we're really saying here.
That's true. Those who have the power to hire and fire are kind of, yeah, in a way.
So China.
Yes.
Is what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yes, the edit of three. All right, so so we got distracted by my bringing up a complete tangent. But so, Kip, when did you start directing some? When was your first directing?
I would say I started directing in earnest, like, in high school. Yeah, I took a video production course, and It's all the only class I really deeply cared about other than maybe English. But they couldn't get me to read what they assigned. So that was kind of, you know, but that was just making little shorts and stuff like that with friends, you know, on a DV camera, learning to edit, kind of starting to learn just the nuts and bolts of things and getting in touch with that, the instincts and figuring out what else I needed to strengthen.
And was that the era when digital editing had finally hit home and sort of at a consumer level that you could do some stuff on a computer?
Yeah, it was like right at the cusp of that, basically. Yeah, it was like it'd been around for a few years. Yeah.
I feel like iMovie being included on every Mac helped so many people.
I mean, it's one of those things where even once you get into more advanced levels of video editing where you're even doing like mat work, let's say, you know, it's all kind of the same concept of like, it's collage work, you know, and like cutting between the shot that looks the same and then there's character there and then you cut to where they're not there anymore. And a lot of special effects are really kind of like that, where it's like you're just taking different layers of reality and blending them together or comparing, you know, immediately contrasting them, like, you know, Eisenberg style. And it's that simple, you know. Yeah, it's.
And you know, how long before you two met on these paths?
Well, I guess we were both in our early mid 20s when we made the film.
I was like late 20s, yeah.
Yeah, we met because we were looking for directors for Three Roads. That is how we met. We didn't know each other before. And we were seeking, so my producing partner and I, Amanda, who's also one of the actresses in the film, went seeking the person who would feel like the right collaborative fit. And, you know, put out some specifics about the film and our vision, what we were up to, on like, I don't know, Craigslist or something, to attract interested filmmakers, and then would check out their like short films and then narrowed it down to a very few that we met in person. And Kip was the one where when we sat down, we felt like we were on the same wavelength and something felt good on a gut level about the collaboration.
Right. So Three Roads was something you and Amanda wrote. And then you decided, okay, we're doing this one.
Me, Amanda, and Vanessa, the other lead actress in the film as well. Vanessa didn't produce, but she also co-wrote. We all, Kip and the three of us wrote the story, and Kip ultimately wrote the screenplay. It started with me. I was listening to this coach I love, you know, one of her videos that I listened to, and she said, you know, if there were no obstacles, what would you do? And for some reason in that moment, I just knew, I was like, well, I would produce and star in an indie film. And something, I don't know why that day was different from every other day, but it was just the right moment. And I was like, what am I waiting for? And that very moment, I was in my parents' house and I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to make a film in my parents' house. Who do I want to act with? And I thought of Amanda and Vanessa, which I love like intuition because they didn't know each other. And I think one of the strongest things about the film is the chemistry of the three of us. But I just somehow something inside of me, you know, or bigger than me just knew it was like, it's Amanda and Vanessa, even though they've never met. And even though I barely know Amanda, did we just know each other in the acting class? We hung out like once. And, I wrote up, I was like, okay, what could we create that we would make in my parents' house? And where each of us, we get to play a really interesting character that is not who we are, but that we would be cast really well as. And I just wrote up this, like, I don't know, paragraph long idea and emailed Amanda and Vanessa and was like, do you guys want to do this? And so we started meeting once every other week to craft the story. And because we're all actresses, of course, we started with our characters. You know, we had kind of the seedling sketch of a story from that little first paragraph I sent. And we built on it together as who our characters are. We would go off and develop that and come back together. And then from that, that. We wrote like a structure of an outline kind of thing. And so we had it at like, I don't quite remember, but it was somewhere like a 10 to 20 page outline by the time that we felt really excited about, by the time we started looking for a director to come on board. And we thought we were going to shoot it Swanberg style, where all it would ever be is an outline. But when Kip came onto the team, he very politely pointed out, he's like, I love that idea. The thing is, Swanberg was the director, writer, cinematographer, editor, so it worked that, you know, but like, we're first time filmmakers and there's four of us and it's not going to work. Like, it's not all in one person's brain. So I think for communication purposes, and I think to make sure we actually make a feature, we really need a screenplay. And we were like, yeah, okay, we agree.
Yeah, if you had done, it might have been beautiful what the other system would have done, but it also might have taken you a couple years.
Yeah, right? I mean, I still want to make films that way. Like, that is what I want to do. And my favorite scenes in Three Roads, we made that way. And then like I made a short, and the best moment in the short was like that improv. Like, that's still the Duplass brothers and Swanberg. They really inspire me in that way, and it's still how I want to make movies. But I totally agree that like where we were at, that was the thing to do at the time. And also, Kip wrote some like brilliant effing lines into the screenplay that are some of the best like funny moments in the screenplay for sure.
And you know, I have to give it to Kip. I mean, obviously the one of the wonderful things about Three Roads for me is the clarity and honesty of the female voice and the female voices. And so big props to Kip that you were able to bring it together and write out the screenplay in a very unselfish way, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I mean, I like there's like board members of the festival. A woman who rightly points out stuff, and like we saw The Favorite together, and she goes, even though there's like a man's name and a woman's name on that script, the guy totally, it's the, only a guy wrote that script. And then I read an article like a month later that he had taken the woman's work and completely rewritten it, and it was a male voice. So like the female voice being so strong, I think, is one of the strengths of the film.
Yeah, the highest compliment I think anyone really paid me was your mom, Sarah Hensy, saying the line about the one character wanting a career and all this stuff. And like, how'd you come up with that? Like, cause she said that was me. That's exactly how I feel, you know? And, I will say I'm not a really big believer in the idea of a male voice and a female voice. Cause some, you know, I worked, for a management company and I read just a ton of screenplays, and a few of the most like seemingly misogynistic stories were written by women. Weirdly, like, I think it's one of those, it's, to me, it just seems like there's good writing and bad writing, you know, and, you know, without touting Three Roads as really good writing necessarily. A lot of the things that people point out and they say, oh, this is because somebody didn't understand the character. It's like, you can say that about how a writer's relationship to any character, regardless of the gender or race or creed or any of that stuff of that writer or the character. Which is just to say, my whole approach was just like, these are just people, you know? And if, you know, I don't think it's that hard to relate to another human being. And I mean, that's what I personally really love about film. You know, like one of my favorite things about just stories in general is like, it can really put you in the shoes of another person whose life couldn't be more different from your own in every conception of the word. And even on a scientific level, you know, there's all these studies that show how literature builds empathy in people. You know, and I don't think that's, so I don't think it's baseless, but, yeah, it's like, I didn't come to them thinking, okay, these are women that I'm writing and I need to treat them like women. How do women talk? I just thought like they're human beings. They have, you know, human beings have every opinion under the sun. They should,
Well, I'm going to still cling to my compliment, because what I just heard is you're not sexist and you don't see women as objects. You see them as human beings. And I think that's kind of what I, you know, there could have been, you know, there could have been a, when people talk male, female voice, I totally get what you're saying. I'm appreciating your idealism and the fact that you have a mind that sees people as equals, regardless of gender,
No, no, I'm sorry. I wasn't deflecting your
No. But I didn't feel like you were rejecting the compliment. I just mean to
I was saying if anything,
your answer included the lack of sexism that I was talking about.
Oh, okay. It's very validating for me to hear that is what I'm getting at, because that is my approach. And then of course I always have that voice of doubt in my head of like, but maybe that's the opinion of you, a white man, that everyone's kind of this, you know, mostly the same, but, you know, then like having Hensie say, like, I felt that way, you know, and like, I remember writing that and feeling like it was a little bit of a risk, you know, to inject that opinion into a character whose life I will never really get to ever experience, of course, but. Yeah.
And say in this project, I think Sarah, Amanda, Vanessa wouldn't have accepted any kind of butchering of it by a level of sexism.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to add, like, I completely agree with what you're saying and complimenting Kip on, but I think the least sexist thing you did, Kip, is you collaborated with three women and you didn't act like you knew better than us because you were the director or you were male. And I think that anyone writing anything that isn't their own, purely their own perspective or any, is very well served by having collaborators in some regard, like whether it's, you know, fellow writers, whether it's your producers, whether it's, some experts that you bring, like we're going to talk later about favorite movies and I'm going to mention Coco. And I was just reading today because I'm like, wait, I don't think these filmmakers were Latino. And I looked into the process they went through to make sure that the film was culturally sensitive and resonated with Latino people. I think that's vital. Like, yes, your mentality, Kip, of these are humans, let me think like a human, all for huge compliment to you. And I think any artist writing from a different point of view is very well served to bring in collaborators or consultants to support and point out like, hey, have you thought about this moment? What about that? I think that's how we actually really create a more real world in our creations.
And I'm going to assume that Three Roads was highly collaborative, even if Kip sat down and pumped out the screenplay that was essentially the blueprint for the project. Yeah, I'm sure on a daily basis, everyone had equal voices.
Yeah, Kip pumped out the screenplay. We were really pleased with it, but then we sat down and like hashed out the things that we wanted to like dive into more or flesh out more or shift. And it was really collaborative. Like it wasn't. My experience, you can tell me, Kip, if you feel differently, but my experience was that like we all really like brought our opinions to the table and felt heard and ended up with something that none of us would have created on our own, but was better because of the collaboration or different because of the collaboration. I don't know. And then, I lost my train of thought. I'll stop talking, see if it comes back.
Oh, well, yeah, it was definitely deeply collaborative. And I mean, it's kind of, we kept building on top of each other. I think where, you know, I remember reading it was like 13 or 14 page outline and I hadn't agreed to doing anything yet. And I had kind of told myself, I was like, well, I'm only going to say yes if I can find sort of my way into it. Like, what is the contribution that I can make? And for me, it was just the baseline of like, I think the theme is friendship. And, you know, why do some friendships fall by the wayside? Why do we outgrow certain people and other people, they stick with us our entire lives? You know, because I have a lot of personal feelings about that, you know, and it's not wrapped up. And that's something that's universal. And so, you know, even the script I pumped out was in service to that original core theme, you know. And yeah, it's like I took it in a direction that was personal, just kind of by virtue of having to. But, that's where it's like constructing a building and you guys put up the framework and I kind of, I don't know, I did the stonework or something and then we worked it, you know, we filled in all the gaps and made all the decisions together in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It was a really beautiful collaborative process that I'm very proud of. And I remember what I was going to say, which is that, so Kip wrote the screenplay, then we hashed out a few things and Kip finalized the screenplay. And then when we were on set, we a lot of the lines are exactly the lines Kip wrote, because especially the humorous lines, right? Because it's like there's a rhythm to that humor that is lost if you say the line differently. But the lines that aren't humor, we said the lines in our own words. So we kind of went back to that idea that I had originally wanted to do of the, like, we have a structure, but we're improvising. But it was stricter than that because it was line by line, but said in our own words kind of thing, which I think helped add to the organic feeling, but also to the collaboration, because now the words Kip wrote were filtered through each actress.
Yeah, which is I think why I responded to it. And particularly what Kip said about friendship, I couldn't help but for the first time it just occurred to me, I actually come from a trio of lifelong friends. Starting at age 12, the three of us were just kind of like three best friends dynamic, not two best friends dynamic. So the fact that the friendship dynamic in your film is so genuine, I think that really is why I locked into it, because I'm, you know, of a trio.
Right.
And trios are 1,000 times trickier, I think, friendship wise than a duo, and you even, you know, and that's present. So I think it is just the genuineness of the relationships. And hearing Sarah say that, you know, you made the words your own, obviously that adds to it being, you know, just a genuine, movie experience where you're, you know, there's different types of movies, right? There's movies where it's an adventure and there's movies where it's this. And this is a movie where the audience gets to be part of the friendship, right? It's really feeling like you're spending time with these people. It's not, you know, will they survive the elevator falling down the shaft?
Maybe it should have been.
The whole film could have been set
should have been
slowly falling to earth.
Three wires. It's the three wires holding them. And they're like, we are the wires that pull each other up at the end.
You know,
maybe that's the sequel.
Sequel. Yeah. There you go. And was it a long process, or did you all just kind of hit it and get it done?
Well, I think from where I agreed to direct it, and I said, but I think I do want to write a screenplay. I think it was like 6 months, right, that I wrote it.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And then maybe a month of us kind of retooling it, like in pre-production. And then I would also describe shooting as a whole rewriting process too.
Sure.
Like the whole way through.
Yeah. And we shot for 2 weeks, right? Yeah. And then editing, of course, is a whole ball game that Kip blew us away on. So talented.
So you did a 2-week shoot. You didn't do like a thing where you did like weekends. You just stopped your lives and everyone worked on it solid for 2 weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. We had like a 2-day break in between like 6-day spates of shooting, I think. Right.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I think it might've been like a 12-day shoot altogether. Yeah.
Right, 12 days over 2 weeks. And, I mean, you got everything you needed? I mean, I can't remember the running time, but it's not short. So you, right? It's not...
It's like the shortest you can be and still be a feature. I think it's like 68 minutes long or something.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
It's pretty wild. It was, I think, like a full 90-page screenplay. And then it does run pretty quickly, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, dialogue-based films do, the pages fly by, I think.
Yeah.
But still, you got 30 pages a week done, or 45 pages a week done.
Damn, I guess.
That's a pace.
We're moving. I mean, back to where we were talking about why I wanted to do a screenplay, it was actually mostly logistical in my mind, where I was like, I could see us getting overwhelmed really quickly with how much we had to film and have it feel like there's movement and things happening. And I knew that, like, we had Vanessa flying in from Paris to shoot her bit. So I was like, we don't have the luxury of kind of finding the film while we go, really. Like, I wanted to make sure I kind of felt like I knew where we had a course charted or something.
Well, especially with a 2-week limit, I guarantee that, right, the films made by those cool Midwesterners who just kind of figure it out, I think they let it go for a while.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I think Chris Nolan filmed his first feature over the course of like 5 years or something, you know, and it's a great way to do it for sure. And then especially back then where even just the act of filming cost you quite a bit of money. It was a little more requisite probably, but
yeah. And with someone coming in from Paris, it's not like you had the luxury of saying, okay, let's work 3 days every other week. We'll do every other weekend and we'll tweak the script in between, like, you know, cause some wonderful indies are made that way. Cause you know, then, but it's, you know, weekends over the course of 6 to 8 months. So you crammed it all in like an old fashioned movie, get it all done.
Yeah, that's right.
And then edit.
How long did it take? I can't even.
For me,
it was a blur
because
I was working nights and then editing during the day. And then I ended up doing the color correction as well.
Oh, God, yeah.
And like you said, the principle of photography was like a rewrite. Was editing like a rewrite?
Some scenes, yes. Like one scene in particular, especially so. But no, not really.
It came out the way you expected?
I'm pretty good, like, on set, actually, about feeling, like, take-to-take, knowing what I have, kind of in a rough, you know, almost like an artist palette. Like, I have this part of this take I really liked, and I felt like the dynamic is working, and then I can cut to this, and then back to this other take. And so I kind of had a schematic in my head of what it was going to look like and kind of sound like and feel like. You know, Sarah, I think that's part of the reason you were blown away by my editing is because, you know, maybe this is a failure as a director for all I know, but like shooting the stuff like the grocery store montage and finding out later that you were kind of freaking out because you felt like you had no idea what was happening and you thought it was falling off the rails. But for me, it was like I very much had an idea of how it was going to fit together.
Oh, God, I don't even remember freaking out, but that sounds very much me. So I believe, yeah. But now that's like one of my very favorite scenes. I love that scene.
Yeah. It's funny. I can't remember. I don't think we were. I guess we were. Yeah. Back to sort of even just talking about editing digitally and stuff. Like, I think my instinct is when I'm filming stuff to come at it from an editor point of view, just to feel like I have the shots I needed. Like even when I first started, like in those little old high school movies and stuff, I didn't write scripts for the first, at least handful, you know, and I would just tell my friends and that, you know, the actors or whatever, what to do. And I would just get the shots I needed and like almost, finding out later, almost in a very John Ford-esque way of like no coverage, just the, you know, the inserts that I need to tell the story and that having nothing extraneous to cut between.
Maybe that's part of how we were able to shoot in 2 weeks. That was going on in your brain that I didn't even know about.
That's also probably why I looked like a mad scientist some of the time.
And especially at the indie level, I think that is the task of the director and crew is you have to get what you need for that edit. I mean, you have to have the final product in mind or there won't be one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you can't throw a bunch of money at reshoots and post tricks.
It's one of those things where I, you know, I've really like that, like with directors like John Ford, and I think Paul Thomas Anderson in a recent interview was talking about coverage in that sense and how not relying on coverage forces you to make decisions basically and choices and really commit to them. You know, and like I've been dabbling like in like analog photography lately, and it's a really similar thing where with digital photography, where I learned it's like you can do so much trial and error and just kind of throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. And with, you know, analog photography, it's like you really have to stop, think, and consider and kind of attack it from an angle. And I think, at least for me, I feel like I thrive in that kind of environment where it feels like there are stakes involved and it feels like there's no going back from this. You really have to put some thought into what you want it to be and try to hit that mark.
Absolutely. I love that you keep mentioning John Ford because I believe he has my favorite quote about filmmaking of all time or specifically about editing, which is It's easy to edit a film. Just cut out the boring stuff.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was no nonsense, that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Just yeah. Words is telling the story. Just tell it.
Yeah.
So you get it done and you start sending it out to festivals, huh? I happen to know because we have our history. You submitted it to Sherman Oaks and when did I write you the email?
So I believe we had submitted to Sherman Oaks, didn't hear anything, didn't get in, then submitted to LA Film Invasion. When we submitted, you wrote us and we're like, okay, guys, you were actually really close for Sherman Oaks. And I wasn't supposed, everybody told me not to tell you that, but now I'm going to tell you because you submitted to me twice now and we'll try to get you into this one. I can't make any promises, but we'll see what we can do. And we were so happy when we got that email, like somebody almost let us in.
I might've sent that. That might've even been pre-COVID because,
I think it was, yeah.
Admittedly, once as a festival programmer, the only thing I enjoyed about COVID was, hey, now theater time is not an issue. So,
yeah.
You know, if the jury loved, you know, seven features, all got decent ratings, it's not like you can show seven features in a 4-day festival. It's just, you know, you can't.
Right.
So,
yeah, that makes sense.
So shifting virtual gave a little more breathing room for sure.
Awesome.
Which was nice.
Yeah.
And how did the festival run go?
So it got into LA Femme after that email, right?
I don't remember the order. I think LA Femme might have been first, actually. Was it after the email, but before?
That's what I was thinking. It was before the LA Film Invasion.
Yeah. And that was lovely. What we discovered, okay. So we didn't just go, oh, we made a film. I know, we'll submit it to film festivals and then somebody will love it and buy it and our careers will be made. Like, we were not naive. I did so much research into distribution and discovered that the film was going to be impossible to distribute. And there was nothing that we could spend money on to help it get distributed better because it's a general audience pleasing film with no niche and no stars. So you can't market it. Even if we tried to market it ourselves, like, because it's so, like, people, there is an audience for it who would love this film, but getting them to know the film exists and then pay money to see the film, like, it's just not gonna happen. And I won't, you know, go down the rabbit hole of why distribution didn't make any sense and wasn't going to work for our film. But we also discovered by submitting to festivals, which this part was a surprise for me and I didn't understand. Most festivals didn't want it because it is just like a heartwarming, you know, we said from the beginning, we want to make a film that's funny and touching and celebrate women's friendships. And that's what we did. We made this film and it's a general audience pleaser. That's not what most festivals want. Most festivals want something very edgy or very like niche. And it just doesn't fit most festivals' molds, or it needs to be like so brilliantly crafted. You cannot deny it. It's one of the best films you've ever seen. And it was none of those things. And so most festivals, it wasn't the right fit. And so when there was a festival programmer who responded to it and it was a good fit, it just felt lovely to have a home to share. And we actually won an award at the LA Film Fest. It was the best award too, because for some weird reason, that festival has a screenplay award and a writing award. And we got the writing award, which was the only award you could have given that film that celebrated all four of us main creative collaborators. So it's just like this really cool, special little bow.
Yeah. And that's the LA Femme?
LA Femme Film Festival. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we just had a film play at our festival in November and they were at LA Femme the week before. Like, LA Femme is, I'm very glad that they included you, because it would have been sort of ridiculous for a festival that's so devoted to women's stories to have not responded to Three Roads, because, you know, seems tailored.
Yeah, I think so. Like, both in front of the camera and behind the camera, you know.
For sure. I'm glad they didn't punish you for hiring a white male director.
Well, you know, they probably saw the same value we did, which is who is the collaborator who's going to be the best fit on this.
For For sure.
We tried to hire a female director. We interviewed some, but Kip was the best fit. We were kind of like, damn it. Well, okay.
which is nice. That proves that you were judging your potential directors based solely on their merits.
Yes, although I want to say to that, please go read the book written by Naomi McDougall Jones about sexism in Hollywood, because I just read it and it was so eye-opening. And it's easy for me to say like, oh yeah, we tried to interview people and Kip was the best fit. But the problem is there were fewer female filmmakers or directors to interview. Why is that? It is not because women are less qualified to be directors. It's because the entire system, from the films we're showing them when they're children to how the films we're showing them in film school and how they're treated there, that is like creating this effed up system. And then there are like tons of overqualified female directors that cannot get jobs. Like it's insane what's happening. And please go read her book, because she expressed it all with very clear data and it's mind boggling. So I do want to say that. I don't want to just leave it at the surface level. Like, well, we interviewed and Kip was the only one we could find. I'm sure there's some incredible female director out there that we didn't get to meet because of various systemic bullshit that's in place. But at the same time, I don't regret that, because it was a beautiful collaboration with Kip, and I'm so grateful that we got to work together.
No, and at a very early level in our society, female creatives are pushed certain directions, mm-hmm. and very rarely are they pushed towards directing. So yeah, the pool of potential directors isn't as deep as it should be. I won't say which one, but a couple years ago, one of the board members sent me an email and said, hey, a lot of female directors in Film Invasion this year. And actually asked the question, like, was there a quota sort of thing? And I was like, no, that's just natural. And by the way, what you think is a lot, it was like not quite a third.
Yeah.
And to him, that was like, wow, such great female representation. I'm like, yeah. Half the people on the planet are responsible for a third of the films. And that's so noticeable that I got an email. Like it tells you something.
Yeah. And I want to just give a shout out. I mentioned Naomi McDougall Jones' book. It is called The Wrong Kind of Women. It is brilliant. Everybody should be reading this. It should be in every film school. It is shocking, the data. And so I just wanted to actually say the title of the book. If anyone's listening, please go read. It is mind boggling.
I'm actually going to let you two talk while I email myself that title, because I'm going to go on holiday soon and I'm with a Kindle. So I'm going to get that book.
It's so good, but you'll also be really mad about the incredible extent of the systemic sexism that is present in the industry.
Yeah, I will be for sure. But I mean, whatever, we're raising a daughter, and I have hope and enthusiasm for the future, because even though she didn't win, even Hillary just running, like, you tell this kid that people my age never thought there'd be a female president, she looks at you like you just said, you know, the sun comes up at night. Like, it just doesn't make sense. She's like, what do you mean? Women run for president. It's just something that happens. She's like, what do you mean? There's always been a black president, like first 8 years of her life. You know what I mean? So that book sounds wonderful. And I'm hopeful that the future is getting better.
I believe it's getting better.
Than the men of my generation.
Yeah. I mean, people, like, we can all be frustrated that progress doesn't happen faster, but progress does happen. And I believe in it.
Absolutely. Well, that's so interesting that really this, well, so now we're on the subject of sexism in Hollywood, which is endless, but,
and also not a minefield at all.
You know, so. No. Well, luckily,
no strong feelings
totally
about
casual
that.
Topic, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. I know. And of course, well, anyway, so Three Roads, you know, hopefully. So is that why you chose to just put it on Vimeo? And
Yeah, because ultimately it doesn't make any financial sense. Like, we could probably get some kind of distribution deal where it gets thrown up on, or we could like put it on Amazon, you know, like there are places that we have access to, we can put up the film and people could pay us money, but we're going to make like a few dollars, and it costs more than that to get the film ready for distribution. Like, we're going to spend more money just to put it on a platform where nobody will watch it and we'll only make a few bucks. And then, like, technically, we should keep the LLC running if we're going to be making a few bucks. And that costs $800 a year in California. Like, it makes no sense. And so, ultimately, like, yeah, it would be great if people could watch this film that, you know, it's not a perfect film, but... like I said, we wanted it to be funny and touching and celebrate women's friendships. And it absolutely checks all three of those boxes. And it's authentic. And a lot of people who watch it love it. It would be great if more people could watch it. That's not the position we're in right now. Maybe someday one of us will become famous and then there will be a market for the film. But until then, we'd rather have it up for free so there's no barrier. I mean, in these days with all the streaming services, you charge 1 cent for your film and nobody's going to pay for it because they can go watch films on Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and HBO and wherever they want to watch it. And so we'd rather just have it up for free so that people have who would like to watch it have access to it.
For sure. And you're absolutely right. It is funny. You have a very clear producer's mind because even just the closed captioning required for those types of releases, you know, you're going to pour hundreds of dollars into.
Yeah. And, you know, there are ways to get those things done more cheaply, but the answer is labor. And you know what? Our time is actually worth money too. And to what end? Like, if we were going to put in that time and then in response, our film was going to be able to make even several thousand dollars, like maybe worth the time, you know, and get in front of more eyeballs, maybe worth the time, but it's not even going to make several thousand dollars. And we could be busy creating something else that matters to us instead of like doing distribution work that is not fun to do and that won't really create an exciting outcome.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Do you get, I worry about asking this kind of question, but do you ever get, you know, viewers on Vimeo sending you a note and or commenting and giving some nice feedback or?
Not yet. If anyone, listening wants to go watch and give us a nice comment or even a rude comment, we're open. And, you know, we got nice comments from, like we have a bunch of quotes up on the website from, like test audiences that we worked with when we were in early drafts of the film. And I like to reread those sometimes and be like, oh, like other people think it's touching too. Other people laughed too. Other people found it authentic too. And that feels good.
It's true. And obviously the Vimeo is an ocean.
Right. I'm not expecting anyone to just randomly organically discover it on Vimeo, although yeah, you never know what might pop up in somebody's search. It's more like somebody can listen to this and then go Google it and watch it, or we can tell friends and family or new people we meet. You know, it's just we decided that was, given all of our options, just having the film available for anyone who wants to view it felt like the best
for sure fit. And it makes perfect sense. And like you said, why spend a couple thousand dollars to get it on some platforms where, you know, honestly, it would just be for the ego.
Yeah.
Being on there.
And Amazon would be cheap to get onto, but Amazon are as exploitive of artists as they can possibly be. They walk the line. They will say, how far can we exploit and have the artists still come to our platforms? And I'm like, no, thank you. Like this, I'm not doing it.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah. It's interesting. I made a short film a few years before 3 Rows called Atheist Anonymous. And, it's pretty interesting how the internet works, like the algorithm or something, because I had made a Facebook page for it around the time I had submitted to festivals and everything. And to this day, every month it gets 2 or 3 new followers or likes. You know, and so recently I even asked, I was like, you know, how are you people seeing this movie? Like, why, you know, how are people coming to find the Facebook page? Because that's up on Vimeo, I think, too. And I didn't even get a response. And
I think the title helps a lot.
I'm pretty sure people are just joining it because it says something about Atheists Anonymous, and they're like, yeah, that's me. And so they like it or whatever. Like, it's not, you know, so yeah, it's just interesting with the internet how it's, it does need to have that kind of a niche or that sort of a hashtag point for people to look into it.
It's so true, actually. If there's anything I can advise filmmakers on, it's title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have a terrible title from that marketing perspective. Really works well for like the themes in the film.
Well, but as you're saying, it's just a sweet, sincere film about friendship and coming of age in a way. And it's coming of age at a time that I think it's ignored a lot in cinema, right? Like everyone cares about the coming of age, like in the teens when you're first, you know, whatever, there's a million movies made about the first time people have sex. This is about the real transition to adulthood, really.
Yeah, you know, it just struck me, Jeff, as you were speaking, that I bet a lot of film festivals didn't respond. I bet the reason you had more women in your film festival than a lot of people do is you do not seem to have a lens of only valuing the stories that are from your perspective as a white male, right? And so, and I can tell that because you saw our film and were like, oh, this is about friendship. I guarantee you there are white males who saw the film and said, this is boring. Why am I watching this? And I don't think it's a coincidence that then your film festival ended up with so many female filmmakers in it because you, it sounds like you had a more open lens. And I'm saying this is unconscious. I don't think there are white dudes sitting around going like, films by females are worthless. Like I'd not, it's not that. It's the subconscious mind of what stories we're drawn to and how open we are.
And I mean, at the risk of like virtue signaling, like too much, like, I mean, I have friends who are like, I have friends, you know, whether it's the people who would see Three Roads and say something along the lines of, you know, something sexist about the film, or, you know, the assholes who say like, I just don't like female stand-ups. You know what I mean? Like they just look at women and they just, you know, they're like, now if you're not being a sex object, I'm kind of over you. You know what I mean?
Like, and I don't think anybody's doing it. I'm not going to say anybody. I think most people are not doing that kind of thing consciously.
No, like, it's never conscious.
You know, I relatively recently in the last year or two realized like, huh, almost every piece of media I consume was created by a white person. It's not because there's a lack of media created by other people, but I haven't gone out of my way looking for it. Why not? And really look at that and then start to make a change. Like it's these unconscious biases. I don't think, you know, film programmers were watching Three Roads. I mean, whatever. I'm not saying Three Roads is the greatest film and should have gotten to every film festival. I'm just saying, I guarantee you somebody somewhere was like, this is boring because they didn't personally relate.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, but the good thing is people can personally relate. So that's good.
Yeah. And that we can all stretch beyond ourselves to be like, oh, this thing that on a surface level didn't relate to me, if I actually pause to watch it for a moment, this really does relate. And actually, now my world view is expanded because I watched this thing that was created by artists who are different, look different from me.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I know. It is weird. I mean, sometimes this probably falls into the category of what I shouldn't say. But sometimes I feel like saying to the dudes, I'm like, you got to be really good because I'm so bored of males. I'm already violating whatever. I'm going to use the term male story again. But the male point of view on things, I've seen a lot of films already with that. So there is just something fresher, and it's better cinema to have a fresher point of view that I haven't seen, you know, just like I thought Booksmart was fantastic. Right. And finally a high school movie that wasn't centered around, you know, the boys and, you know, if you're going to make a boys coming of age high school movie at this point, you've got 500 or I don't know how many great films ever made. But you know what? I'm very poorly saying that just as a viewer, I would rather see something new that I haven't seen done before.
That is so funny. I just realized right in this moment, the movie 10 Things I Hate About You I love that film. And it never occurred to me right until this moment, like, yeah, it's a rare high school coming of age film with like a complex, not 100% likable female character as the center. Never occurred to me till just now. And it's like, it just goes to prove, like, I'm not the only person who loves that film. It's like when they finally break through because the stupid system wasn't like, no, audiences won't like that. Like, audiences do.
They do. It's based on The Taming of the Shrew, isn't it?
Yes.
So Shakespeare.
Which is very sexist, but the I Don't Think 10 Things About You is, you know, turned it on its head in a modern way.
Oh, I see.
For sure. All right, well, what has been going on since the Three Roads experience? I always try to wrap us up with what you're working on next.
You want to go, Kip, or shall I?
Sure. Sorry, I'm kind of stuck in thought about, you know, all the gender stuff.
I brought up a lot of politics.
Yeah, no, I mean, we could stay on gender for a bit longer, but, you know.
I think I would just say maybe I'm more optimistic, which is often written off as naive, and maybe it is naive, but I don't know if I subscribe to people necessarily. It's sort of like back to where we were talking about with the internet and hashtags, and you know, for 40 years before that was called demographics, you know, and like, yeah, people I think are drawn towards what seems relevant to them, and maybe especially now with the attention economy, you know, where there's so much more supply than there can ever be demand. It's, you know, people have to filter things out somehow. And maybe that's one of the ways that they're doing it is like, oh, this, yeah, subconsciously, this is a voice that I relate to. But, I think people are more open to, expanding their horizons than maybe we give them credit for.
Oh, I agree with you.
I would say, I mean, I've thought a lot about Three Roads too and why it wasn't more successful. And, you know, I have a number of theories about what I could have done differently as a director, but subject matter wise, I would say, you know, it's not that we didn't make a movie that has like a hilarious opening 10 minutes, you know, with like a really great gag or something. It's, you know, I really did make the movie I wanted to make in the sense of I wanted it to be kind of quiet, kind of melancholy, not really trying to grab your attention and say, pay attention to me. Because it really came back to the whole idea of friendship. And for me, friendship is kind of a sad thing. It's kind of a bittersweet thing. And it kind of makes sense to me that, you know, there's such a... And Jeff, I'd love to hear your opinion on this too, but it's like, it seems to me that when you approach a piece of art and you don't know anything about the people who made it, it's like, you're really putting yourselves in the hands of like an Uber driver of your emotions. And it's like, I think at least in my opinion, you're pretty like cagey or standoffish, and you're not really willing to like, to put the trust in to be like, oh, this is coming from a good place. You know, like, cause I've thought of just filmmakers like PTA and stuff and how, you know, he did Hard Eight and like, it didn't really make a splash, but then Boogie Nights, which was just like this bombastic, huge epic, you know, grabbed everyone's attention. And it's like, he didn't even ask you to trust him. He just kind of forced himself upon you. And this is Three Roads is a movie that doesn't force itself upon you. It kind of just presents itself, I think. And,
well, and in the commercial marketplace, I mean, let's be honest, Boogie Nights was about porn.
That too, and, yeah.
You know, as much as it's just actually a brilliant drama with amazing characters and performances, the hook was it's porn about a guy with a huge dick.
Yeah.
And that was the hook to pull in a much bigger audience, whereas Hard Eight was about a gambling addiction, right? So
pretty much, yeah.
So yeah, like, oh, a gambling addiction film. Oh, wait a minute, this is Marky Mark has a I mean, I don't mean to focus too much on it, but it was actually the source of it, right? It one of the most memorable things in the film is when he goes, "Do you need me to go again?" Like it was about, and it was probably the perfect time for a porn movie because porn was the internet was finally like making people admit mm-hmm. that they actually watch it.
Mm. Yeah, it definitely had a hook. You know, I would say if Three Roads likes anything, it might be a hook.
Well, I mean, it has a hook for those who see it, which is honestly, it's the friendships. And I was going to add, it's also a film about mourning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
I think it's hard because even like that is a hook, like, hey, come watch a film about authentic friendship. But even me, like on most days, I'd be like, nah, I don't know. Is that my thing today? Like it doesn't, it's not a good marketing hook, even if it's a hook once you're in it, mm-hmm. you know?
I mean, one of my favorite films is the film American Honey. And I've only seen it once, but it's still like one of my favorite films. And I've only seen it once because it's just, it's a little heavy, you know? And so it's, you know, the comfort food movies that I've watched dozens of times, you know, those are easy for me to watch. And then it's sometimes the ones that make a bigger impact that sound like it might be homework going into it, but then it actually hopefully surprises you with its humanity or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's time and place. I mean, I can't help but note that your film released pretty much into the ether of the pandemic. And these were hard times. And I know our entertainment selections the last year and a half, like people are like, watch, you know, some really great drama. And I'm like, I think we're going to rewatch Parks and Rec.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you just want to feel sure. good at night.
That's very true, yeah.
That's part of why first season of Ted Lasso was so successful, in addition to its excellent, excellent craft work.
You finally watched it?
Oh, I finally watched it. I was so into it. I told
her to watch it. I'm taking credit for it.
I was so mad at the second season. I was like, no, you were so good. What did you do?
Right.
Really? Second season's worse? I guess it's not as, yeah. Honestly,
it's just the first season was so brilliant and the female characters were so rich and delicious and complex and it just like downgraded everything slightly. And it's not that it was bad. It was that the first season was so good. And these days, like it is so, my taste level has gotten so high that it is so hard to find content that I'm that like gaga over. And, you know, and I get bored very quickly if it's not that top content.
I admit it annoyed the piss out of me that like everyone has to fall in love with the same person. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, because it's honestly not even that realistic, right? Like the most positive person is oftentimes the most annoying, you know, and there would absolutely be a clique of people who are like, yeah, they hate Ted Lasso and they still want to get him out of the team or something. But, I don't know.
Yeah, not to be totally rude towards them because they're great writers, and I've loved other shows from what Bill Lawrence's team. But you know, yeah, they have to make every woman on the show has to end up just like focused on a romantic relationship.
I was so disappointed because the Rebecca character is so fascinating and the actress is just incredible. And then when all of a sudden second season was about her love life, I was like, come on, really?
And about her on Tinder with a...
I was bummed.
It was a bummer. It was a bummer that's where they went with her.
She could have been in a really complex, interesting way. Like, it's not unrealistic that she would want to be on Tinder, but just, like, do more. Anyway, my point was just the first season was wonderful, and that part of why it was not only that it was really good, but it was also the right moment for it, because everybody wanted that, like, optimism and the entertainment.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why I watch Letterkenny over and over, because... I live in a world where there's been a lot of serious things going on. So at night, I just want to see people who like their big problem is like, you know, they have an amateur hockey game that night. All right. Well, do you want to share are you both still writing a lot?
Yes, sure. So yeah, I'll pick up the baton. I'm writing a lot. I also had a really rough year last year. I lost my dad, and that kind of hit the reset button on just a lot of the things I was prioritizing. You know, I realized a lot of the stuff, kind of the pots I had cooking creatively, you know, had a little bit of a undertaste of really a little bit of cynicism or something. Like I kind of recognized I was kind of pursuing ideas that I felt like had a lot of really like commercial appeal, you know, and had a higher, you know, higher chance of like landing, well in that, kind of a capacity. And so there's been like a funny process of sort of, getting back in touch with sort of my roots creatively and, motivationally. So it's like, yeah, slow going, but the wheels are turning and I'm writing some stuff and some things are moving along. I did shoot like a short film right around the time of Three Roads. And I finally put the finishing touches on that and put that out into the world. And that'll be premiering, at a time to be determined just because of COVID and stuff with, the LA Indie Film Festival.
Yay.
And I'm really happy and proud of that. That was a lot of fun and hard work. And yeah, that's the gist of it. I feel the muse percolating towards doing something that's akin to like another Three Roads in the sense of something that's homebrew and, really personal. Yeah.
For sure. And Sarah, writing, you're still pumping out the writing or?
Yeah, well, I have been focused on audiobook narration. That's what I'm doing for a living. And through it's super fun because I get to perform for a living. And I found myself pretty frustrated because I, for the same reason that I were like, oh, I'm really a writer and producer because I have a lot of opinions about stories I want to tell. And so I actually am starting a publishing company, which is a super fun marriage. Like I can actually make books both that I want to put into the world and that I can make money at the same time. Because through my audiobook narration, I was working with all these indie authors who are running their author business, you know, six-figure author businesses. And I was learning all about how are they achieving that. And so I'm now combining like my business passion and my creation passion in publishing because it is so much, more affordable and possible, you know, to create a book and audiobooks than it is to create movies. And, So that's like, you know, the creative projects I'm actively up to, and I'm writing my first book right now, which is actually a nonfiction book about, self-esteem for artists. And then simultaneously, my spouse and I were hanging out one day and musing about like, so if money were no obstacle and we could do just anything with our time at all times, what would we be doing? And I was like, every day I would wake up and I would just like create whatever I felt like I like creating that just came from my heart. And then like occasionally organically, one of those projects would be like, you're supposed to make me into fruition and you're supposed to actually go like, you know, fully make me like how Three Roads grabbed me and told me it was supposed to be a feature, you know? And he was like, you're not that far away from that life. And why don't you at least like start small and just, you know, take 10 minutes once a day or once a week and just create whatever you feel like creating in that moment. So I started that. And then I told a friend about it and she called it wonder storming. So, I've been wonder storming and it's this really beautiful, creative process that is surprisingly satisfying. Like I didn't know how, like when he suggested, I was like, yeah, I guess that'll be fine. I don't really know if it like fully fulfills me as an artist. But then I started, I'm like, this is the only thing I need to do as an artist. This is great. Mm-hmm. So wonder storming and also narrating and starting a publishing
company. And wonder storming is whatever occurs to you. It doesn't have to be writing. It could be,
yeah, although from exactly, it could be whatever. I could draw a picture. Typically it shows up in the form, for me, it shows up in the form of a story idea that is either a book story idea or a film story idea. I also do have a film that I've talked to with Kip ad nauseum that's like bothering me in the back of my head that going like, make me someday. And like, I know I'm going to make another film someday. But I also trust like the right moment is going to arise and it's going to be time to do that. It doesn't feel good to like, I'm just not interested. I'm interested in living a life that feels really good, that is a full expression of who I am and that like takes great care of me. And I'm not in a place to just be like, I will push this thing uphill even when it doesn't feel good. And even when it's using all of my resources and even when it's exhausting and frustrating me because I have to be a filmmaker, like I'm not there anymore. I have more trust in the universe of the unfolding. Like I am an artist and I need to be creating for my soul. And for me personally, I like creating as a part of my living because it's just preferable to me to get to exercise my craft for the majority of my day. I've gotten really clear on the separation between like making a living as an artist and being fulfilled as an artist are not necessarily the same thing, because there are lots of things you can do that you're like, people are, you know, going to pay me for this thing and it will be consistent and I can make money doing that craft, that aren't the thing you really want to make from your heart.
Amen. Amen. You're almost describing what I told you before we started recording.
What we were chatting about.
When one is at peace with, that part of oneself.
Yeah. And I will say, like, if anyone would like to hear my work, go to sarahbethgoer.com/demos. Cause that's where all my audiobook demos are. And these are the demos, like I put together demos that are like work I would really enjoy doing, like the exact like narration projects I love. So that's where you can hear like my most current, like best acting work. And then also I recently did an audiobook called Immediate Family. So if you are an audiobook listener, it's literary fiction. I was really, really proud to get to do that one. So Immediate Family is one I recommend.
Excellent. All right, Kip, anywhere people should look, or they just have to wait till your short starts playing around the festival circuit?
Yeah, you just have to wait. Sorry.
No worries. I just always want to make the offer. All right, well, I guess I will wrap us up with my spiel, which is, I guess the first thing I should say is, hey, people, 5 stars maybe, or thumbs up, love, subscribe, follow, like the podcast. I know most people who listen to this are fellow filmmakers listening. I get nice emails from people who are like, hey, I'm enjoying this podcast and enjoying hearing these filmmakers talk about their stuff. And it's always, you know, other creatives, I think, get into what you have to say. But we've had like 110 people on the podcast, and I think on iTunes there's like 12 reviews. So hey, at this point I realized I should ask for it. And and in the world of 5 stars, of course, Discover Indie Film was a podcast that was born out of my programming film festivals, and I wanted to talk to filmmakers more than I got to at the festivals. And then that turned into a TV series that, if you're listening to this and you like indie film, go to the Amazon Prime Video, the aforementioned Amazon Prime Video, and check out Discover Indie Film. It's a TV series of all indie shorts that there's 4 seasons so far. Each season's 10 episodes with about 20, 25 shorts in it. And I'm telling you, it's the cream of the crop of the festival circuit. And I am supposed to say, or to myself, I'm supposed to say, if you want to learn more about this podcast or that TV series, go to discoveringindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's at DIFWINS. And I think we talked about both festivals. Kip and Sarah's film, 3 Roads, was an official selection of Film Invasion LA in 2020. If you want to learn more about Film Invasion LA, we hold it every June. And there's actually people submitting to it right now. So you can learn about it at filminvasionla.com. And on social media, it's at Film Invasion LA. And then there's we talked about, I think we mentioned Sherman Oaks Film Festival. And Sherman Oaks Film Festival is every November. So I just survived it. 8 days in person in a theater. 8 days in a theater. And I still haven't gone back to the movies. But I think Licorice Pizza will be my first. But if you want to learn about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, it's shermanoaksff.com. And it's at shermanoaksff on social media. And I think we're good. Thank you both for a nice long interview.
Thank you, Jeff.
And we'll stop recording, and then we'll record your favorite films for the next episode, which will be you answering the 4 questions. I won't rattle off the 4 questions for people. I'll rattle off at the top of the next one. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Kip.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone who's listening.
Bye, everyone.